Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, author and professor Leonard Moore discusses his book, Teaching Black History to White People. Moore is joined in conversation by Laura McEnany, Vice President for Research and Education at the Newberry Library. The following conversation originally took place May 15th, 2022 at the American Writers Festival and was recorded live.
Good morning. Welcome to the American Writers Festival. This is the Millennium Park stage, and I'm Linda Dunleavy, Director of Development at the American Writers Museum, and I'm delighted to introduce the first program of the day, sponsored by the Newberry Library. This program is presented in conjunction with the AWM's upcoming exhibit, Dark Testament, A Century of Black Writers on Justice. This initiative examines the enduring relevance of works by black writers during the 100-year period between the end of the Civil War and the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement. It will open at the museum later this summer. The subject of how and to whom we teach black history has been made a political cudgel, with book bans and prohibitions of the most innocuous knowledge of America's past published by legislators across the country. Leonard Moore has been teaching black history for 25 years, mostly to white people. Drawing on decades of experience in the classroom and on college campuses throughout the South, as well as his own personal history, Moore illustrates how an understanding of black history is necessary for everyone. With his book, Teaching Black History to White People, which is part memoir, part black history, part pedagogy, and part how-to guide, Moore delivers an accessible and engaging primer on the black experience in America. He poses provocative questions such as, why is the teaching of black history so controversial? And what came first, slavery or racism? These questions don't have easy answers, and Moore insists that embracing discomfort is necessary for engaging in open and honest conversations about race. He's here today to discuss his book with Laura McEnany, Newberry Library President for Research and Education. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Welcome into a conversation that we're going to have. I want to start by asking how many teachers, and that includes current or retired teachers, are in the audience today. Okay, great. Oh, wonderful. Lots of educators. And administrators are educators too. So if you're here, we want you in the conversation as well. So, as she said, this is memoir, history, pedagogy, and how-to, and my questions are going to sort of take us through those different identities and parts of your book. And I come to this, just so you know, I'm currently the Vice President for Research and Academic Programs at the Newberry, but I was a college professor in the classroom for 25 years, and I was the Vice President for Teaching for the American Historical Association. So I was in the trenches with you as we were sort of figuring out, you know, how to face the teaching challenges, especially of the last few years. So I want to start with your own learning of black history. And you talk in the book about growing up in Cleveland in a really interesting neighborhood. And I want to sort of, I want to ask you if you could characterize the quality and kind of black history you learned in K-12.
Well, a lot of it was just me getting on the bus going down to the Cleveland Public Library on a Saturday afternoon. It was the largest OpenStax public library in the country. So people talk about New York City. No, it was OpenStax. You could just floors and floors. So anyway, that's where the love started. I would just sit there and read black newspapers. I finished high school with a 1.6 GPA. And the only class I had higher than a C on other than gym was African-American literature. And the funny thing is my African-American literature teacher in the 10th grade was a white guy who looked like Stephen King. And I remember walking in there on the first day and like, what is he going to tell me about black history? It was amazing. And then I took a black history class after that. And so that sort of started my trajectory. But being born in a house where I had a dad who had never lived in the South, he was from Cleveland. My mom was from rural Washington Parish, Louisiana. I kind of grew up in two worlds. My dad's in-laws, you know, moved to LA in the 1960s. So here I am, a black kid in Cleveland. One set of grandparents in the South, other set of grandparents in Los Angeles. So I kind of grew up with a, you know, a foot in kind of two worlds.
Mm-hmm. So I want to jump from your educational background into your first teaching job after you get your PhD at The Ohio State University. You have to put the in there. And your first teaching job was at Louisiana State.
Yes.
And I want you to talk a little bit about what it's like to teach in the South. And I want to read just a little bit from this. And he says, "My time at LSU showed me that the South is absolutely the best place to teach African American history. Let me say that again. The South is absolutely the best place to teach African American history. I find the South to be one of the only places in the United States where you can have an open and honest conversation about race." So talk more about that.
I mean, I love being at LSU. And, I would teach these black history classes, 300-400 students. I remember one time, I think we had just had a kid. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to teach my class at 7:30 in the morning so I can get home with the kid. And 7:30 in the morning, I had 300 kids sign up for a class 7:30 in the morning. White Southerners want to learn about black history. And what I find in the South, because, you know, we're not really into a lot of that political correctness, I think they are open to having debates. And I'll give an example. I was at an interview at the University of Oregon about 5-6 years ago for administrative position. And somebody said, white guy said, "Well, Leonard, what is your greatest accomplishment as an administrator?" I said, "Well, at Texas, we developed a very, very large, significant, and impactful black male PhD pipeline." His response was, "That sounds very gendered and sexist to me." In what world getting black males more educated is that gendered and sexist? Mm-hmm. And so that's why I said, you know what? In the South, you can focus on black issues in the South. I don't think that's the same in the East Coast or the West Coast. Mm-hmm. I think people are frightened in California. And I remind people, Trump is from New York City. Kevin McCarthy is from California. And Nixon is from California. So the South gets beat up on a lot. Mm-hmm. But I found it to be very, very healthy. You know, I'm in a conservative state in Texas. The state capital, Greg Abbott, is less than a mile from me, but I've never had a problem teaching black history. Mm-hmm. And I get a lot of, I say real white people, real white students in my class, these wealthy white kids with conservative parents. Mm-hmm. And I love it. One quick story, there's a white female in my class, and on the first day she said, "Dr. Moore, my mom didn't really want me to take your class." I said, "Why not?" She said, "She didn't want you to indoctrinate me." I said, "Well, what made her change her mind?" She said, "Well, Dr. Moore," she told me, "after every class, I have to take a picture of the notes, email them to her, and then," she said, "we'll discuss the course material every Tuesday and Thursday night." So the mom bought the books, got the syllabus. The mom emails me in December, thanking me. She explained why she had reservations about her daughter taking my class. She said, "Dr. Moore, you have changed the intellectual trajectory of my family because we never knew black people experienced all this stuff." And so I just like the South because we can just be straight up and honest and be transparent and authentic.
Why do you think that is? And I don't want to build a case here for sort of a Southern exceptionalism, but talk more about why you think that is. Is there something about that they're fighting a Southern identity, so they're leaning into the candor you're describing?
I think in Louisiana and Texas, you got to deal with black people, even if you don't like them. In places like Cleveland, Chicago, you don't have to. I'm just being honest. And so I think they want to learn about it. I don't know if they're trying to fight this stuff. I just think they're curious. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I just think they are very intellectually curious. Yeah. And that's why my classes typically fill up in a day or two when students are registering for the next semester.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so let me say this.
Yeah.
I taught a class with 100 white conservative judges in the state of Texas, a 4-week black history class. The first week, 67 judges. The second week, 75. The third week, about 80. And the last week, about 95. These are Trump-loving judges. And what they all said, "Dr. Moore, we never knew this history. Mm-hmm. And thank you for teaching it in such a way where you didn't blame me for being white."
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. So speaking of teaching audiences, wide audiences, and audiences that aren't people who are attending the university, in 2020, you decide to offer a webinar in the middle of the George Floyd moment and Breonna Taylor moment. You decide to offer a webinar for the university community, and 4,200 people sign up. And this is in a chapter called Black Anger. You describe this webinar, and it's a great success. And then you design a 7-week course, and you get 1,300. So people are curious. Mm-hmm. People are signing up. So I'm wondering if you can talk through the decisions you're making as a historian.
Yeah.
You're a teacher scholar, and you're reaching these wide, wide audiences. And I'm wondering if you can bring us into the decisions you're making about how you're going to describe the history of Black anger. How you're going to contextualize what people are seeing in 2020.
Yeah.
So how do you make those decisions? And can you give us an example or two of how you contextualize Black anger, historicize it?
Yeah, I think most white Americans don't realize the anger that Black folks have. And I can just talk about police brutality. I remember my mother and my grandmother died during the Summer Olympics in 1984 in Los Angeles. My dad and three of his brothers are coming back from the funeral home making preparations. The next thing we know, LAPD has them all face down in the middle of the street because my uncle had an expired license. And these are well-educated Black men. So I saw my dad deal with that. I dealt with police brutality, and my son saw his dad deal with it. Mm-hmm. And so number one is just trying to let people know this stuff is generational. Mm-hmm. It affects them. But also number two, just letting them know that we live in different worlds. My colleagues couldn't believe. I told them when I drive to campus every morning, I am terrified when a police officer gets behind me. They couldn't understand it. I said, to you, I'm Dr. Moore. But to the police officer, I'm just a Black man. Mm-hmm. They had no idea. Mm-hmm. And so, I let people know I'm not speaking for all Black people, mm-hmm. but I believe that my thought is within the mainstream, you know, of African-American intellectual life. And so we live in different worlds. I remember an older white man saying to me, well, Dr. Moore, I just don't see all this racism. He said, I thought things were settled with the 64 Civil Rights Act and the 65 Voting Rights Act. And I said, I appreciate your perspective, but you don't see what I see. And so I remember I spoke to a group, it's a wealthy suburb outside of Austin called Lakeway. And I got a call one day from the Lakeway Men's Club. Now, when I said Lakeway Men's Club, you had a certain image in your mind. That's them. All right. That's them. And I remember I went there and I told that I took some grad assistants with me for protection. B, I just want them to see what it'd be like. And just real quick. And so I said, hey, man, I'm not going to say anything about race. They said I can talk about whatever I want to talk about. I said, I'm not going to say anything about race. I'm going to talk about how we take all these kids abroad. Mm-hmm. Finished speaking, the guy said, Dr. Moore, can I ask you about Black Lives Matter? I said, well, I didn't talk about Black Lives Matter, but I can. And he said, well, I think if you all would obey the police, you wouldn't get shot. Well, the first thing I did, I validated his perspective. I said, I see how, from where you sit, that is your perspective. Mm-hmm. And what I love about it is that when they come at you like that, oh, it's on and popping now. It is on now. And I just asked him, I said, you believe there are bad football coaches? Yes. Are there bad teachers? Yes. Bad investment bankers? Yes. Mm-hmm. Bad lawyers? Yes. I said, how come we can't have bad cops? And so for me, it's letting people know that we have different experiences. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so teaching Black anger, it wasn't easy. Mm-hmm. I had to put myself out there a lot. And I told two stories in there about I showed up at a faculty senate meeting 3 years ago. Now, I've been a professor 24 years. At least they told me I was. I show up at a faculty senate meeting 3 years ago, somebody points to me and refers to me as the assistant basketball coach. And so when I'm relaying all these experiences that Dr. Moore has, mm-hmm. who they look at as a polished Negro, mm-hmm. and I'm like, if I deal with that, what do other people do?
Mm-hmm. Well, and you talk about this example of a Monopoly game.
Yeah, oh, yes.
One of the things
y'all gonna love this.
When you did this... When you did this webinar and you were trying to sort of figure out how do I historicize Black anger, you used the example of the Monopoly game. Can you share?
Yeah. Any good Monopoly players in here? Good? A little bit? I'll give you one Monopoly tip. If you buy all the railroads, you will never go bankrupt. The game will never end, but you will never go bankrupt, all right? but here's the Monopoly example. So let's say we all sit down to play Monopoly, me and six of my white friends, all right? We pass out the money, we pass out the pieces, you got the shoe, the hat, the car, the man on the horse, the thimble, I know the game of Monopoly, right? And we ready to sit down and play. But when we sit down and play, they say, well, hold on, Leonard, do you know the rules? I'm like, yeah, I know the rules. I've been playing Monopoly since I was in Cleveland, Ohio. They say, well, no, Leonard, you know, you're Black, so the rules are different. And I'm like, what are the rules? Leonard, you cannot buy any property until you roll for the 20th time. That ain't in the rule book. Yes, it is. But I can pay taxes. I can land on people and pay rent. And of course, I'm black. I can go to jail, but I can't buy any property. But I'm sitting at the game. And so now when it's my turn to buy property, I got the dice in my hand for the 20th time. I'm ready to buy property. I'm ready to make deals. Guess what has happened to all the property? It's gone. So my friend walks in the house. Leonard, you don't have any property. Well, man, that's because they didn't let me buy property. Leonard, oh, man, you just didn't want to work hard enough. You're lazy. You want a handout. No, they didn't let me. All six of us, seven of us, get up to go to dinner, and what we say is, let's do this. Let's keep the game going, and let's let our children who were upstairs playing video games, let's let them come down and shake our place. My daughter, Lauren, has no money. All the other kids, guess what? They got money handed down from their parents. Lauren's friend says, Lauren, how come you don't have any money? She said, well, y'all are racist toward my daddy. And they say, Lauren, that happened a long time ago. You can't blame us for that. Mm-hmm. And whenever I give that analogy, even the most hardened opponents of black progress say, I get it now.
Right.
And that has been the black experience. We have been at the table.
Right.
It appears we are full participants, but we haven't been.
Yeah. I like the Monopoly story because it gets to the accumulated wealth of
absolutely.
Whiteness.
Absolutely.
They have accumulated that wealth over generations.
Right.
There's something just right. crystal clear about that example. So I want to talk, there's a chapter called Teaching Jim Crow, and you talk a lot about sort of the main points that a teacher would want to hit when they're teaching black history. And I want to ask you if you can talk about how, as a teacher, you teach the history of barbarism, which is the history of lynching. And you note early in the book that on day two of class, you are showing graphic images of lynching. And there are current debates about this in the classroom about how we use these images, how we use any images of violence. And I'm wondering, so first, why do you show them? Should teachers show them? And what are the trade-offs of this teaching move? And I want to set that question up and read a little bit about how he talks about this in the book. You're acknowledging that we don't teach this history in school. Although we don't teach about lynching in school, we need to. But here's why we don't. First, white parents don't want it. And second, there are some black parents who don't want it taught either. So school administrators often get resistance from both black and white parents. Well-meaning principals want to diversify the curriculum, but then they get criticized. So to avoid controversy, they end up doing nothing. I want to dig into this question about the images as a teaching move.
I find the most graphic images I can, and I show them to the class. And Ida B. Wells, you know, who spent some time here in Chicago, on her book, I think it's Red Horse or something like that, she has this graphic description, I think it's the lynching of Sam Holes in Georgia.
Yep.
And she talks about how they were going to lynch him on us. They wanted to lynch him where he allegedly committed a crime at, but they moved it to another city because that other city was on the train line from Atlanta. And she said they specifically put it at 4 o'clock or 3 o'clock because people in Atlanta wanted to go to church first and then get on the train to come to see the lynching. And so I show the graphic stuff. This is history. And I remind people that if you don't show the history, like we talked about a little while ago, it can be erased. Oh, lynchings never happened. The Holocaust never happened. Well, yes, it did. Here are the graphic images. And so my thing is we need to be able to sit with the images, and I don't give students trigger warnings. I'm like, you are grown, you are 18 years old, and we put it up, and y'all got to sit there for 10 minutes and look at it and write down everything you see. And because I remind them, the lynching piece, it's not just about killing an unsanctioned murder. For white Southerners, it's deeper than that. It is a spectacle, you know? And we have to send a message not only to the victim, but to the victim's community that if you ever get out of line, this is what will happen to you. And I tell them sometimes, you know, if you had a family member lynched, the white people would tell you when you can get the body because they want the body to stay there for a couple days just to serve as a reminder. of what will happen to you if you get out of line. But we got to get out of this stuff about, oh, what they call it? They use porn. What do they call it? What's the word they use?
The sort of violence porn.
Violent porn. No, it's American history.
Yeah.
It is American history. And my frustration with black parents, you should be teaching that stuff at home to your kids so when they get to middle school, they are ready for it. But the problem is, and I feel sorry sometimes for white teachers who are thoughtful, trying to talk about black history, one black kid's mother complains, oh, you made my kid feel bad. And guess what happens? The teachers don't do nothing else. And I don't blame them. But we gotta show this stuff. We can't sugarcoat the history. Gotta show it, yeah.
Have you had any pushback from students or other constituencies when
you've... No, I tell them they don't like it to drop the class.
Interesting.
Because if you can't handle this, we got 14 more weeks. Mm-hmm. You can't handle the class.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think what we have done on the college campus, we have coddled students too much. Mm-hmm. And I will say this, I voted Democrat my whole life. But I think liberals have coddled students too much that they don't want to be in a classroom where they ever have to deal with an opposing opinion. You know?
I hear an audience question in the making. So I want to talk about teaching black resistance, black agency. There's this whole history of black institution building, black political thought, black intellectual tradition, and black movements. And you cover the civil rights movement in here, and you start to do something that is familiar to me as a teacher. You're trying to decenter Dr. King as the story, the whole history of the movement. So how do you do that, and why do we need to do that as teachers?
So I think his image has been completely distorted, but that's for a different day.
Yeah.
But I think we have to remind people that these are regular, you know, local people. They're regular people who are the foot soldiers of these movements. Mm-hmm. You know, and one thing I try to point out is that the black community coming out of, you know, I call it the Juneteenth generation, the most dynamic generation, I believe, of Americans ever. I don't care what Tom Brokaw said, but this, he said it was World War II. No, it's the Juneteenth generation. You got to understand, you got 4 million enslaved people coming out of slavery with no map, no blueprint, no guide, and there was this belief that 10 years after slavery, we would die off. That was the belief. But you know what? They leave the plantation. They reunite their families, they change their names, they acquire property, they build schools, they build churches and institutions, and they were so prosperous, that's why you get Jim Crow. That's why you get Jim Crow. We gotta stop this, because they are prospering. And so I remind people that even in the Jim Crow period, you had all this institution building. Over 90 HBCUs created during the Jim Crow period. Your major black church denominations, the eight most popular African-American fraternities and sororities, all these black professional associations during the Jim Crow period. So we have always been about institution building. And I think oftentimes people on the outside want to hold up, quote, a figure, where people on the inside understand that King was what we call a mobilizer. It was black women going door to door in every social movement we had. So that when a King or Malcolm X comes to Chicago, guess what? The people are already organized and they can say, hey, go hear this brother talk. But I think we give King way more credit than he would even take. I mean, I tell people, the Montgomery bus boycott, he was not the leader. Right. The sisters just asked him to be the spokesperson because they understood, because of the gender dynamics, nobody was going to listen to them. But he will tell you that his mentors were Ella Baker and Septima Clark. He will tell you that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something important, too. If we decenter King, we can see women in the movement. And it's one of the reasons we have to do it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I want to move from, and again, there's a, civil rights is just, it just lacks the range of that movement. But as I move from civil rights to black power, knowing there's a lot of overlap and our terms are imperfect, you have written several other books, not just this book about how to teach, but you are a historian of black history. And you teach a course on the black power movement. And There's a lot to say. There's a lot that you talk about in this book about the Black Power movement. And here, too, I think you're dispelling some of the myth-making that mm-hmm. college students arrive with. They have a set of myths about the movement when they get to college. But you say something that intrigued me as a former college professor. You say, the spirit of Black Power would affect almost every institution in American culture, but none more so than higher education.
Absolutely.
So, since this is a panel on teaching and teaching Black history, can you talk about the impact of the Black Power movement on education?
I think we look at the higher ed university system. I mean, the first thing it dealt with getting Black students on the campus. And there was these big debates, these schools. I tell people, let me back up. There are three times in American history where corporate America and universities have said, we got to do better. King assassination, April 4th, 1968. The Rodney King beating, and then the summer 2020. Somebody has to die. Typically, somebody got to die for universities to open up. And so what we saw with the Black Power movement, there were these big debates about, yeah, we want Black students in, but are we going to lower the bar? Who's going to teach them? Where are they going to stay at? Can the university handle a large influx of Black students? Mm-hmm. But the bigger debate was around the teaching of Black history and Black studies. White professor said, Black people have made no contribution that would warrant a semester-long course. That was number one. Number two, where can we find the faculty to teach? Number two, and number three, would these courses have any intellectual merit? Mm-hmm. So I remind students that my presence teaching a Black history class at a place like LSU or the University of Texas is a direct result of the Black Power movement.
Yeah. You and I are sitting here because of movements.
Absolutely, absolutely.
The movements brought us to this stage, right. And we have to always remember that and sort of unpack that history. So moving forward to a chapter on teaching white liberals, and this is where I saw myself. And I thought, oh, okay, I got to reread this chapter a few times. I love that you sort of decide to sort of center this quote this about teaching white liberals, and I want to share a couple of pieces from this, and I want you to talk through some of your action and agenda items for the white liberals. So you start the chapter by saying, now that you've learned about the Black experience, let's talk about what to do with the knowledge. While I, as a Black man, appreciate many of the gestures of support shown for Black Lives Matter by corporations, universities, professional sports leagues, and others in the summer of 2020, we must move beyond what you call performative justice. So I'm wondering if you can share some of your action commitments you're asking white folks to make, so we get to the discomfort mm-hmm. you were asking us to sit with.
Okay, let me say this first. I drove by Soldier Field. Y'all put a spaceship on top of that?
Yes.
Most bizarre thing I've ever seen in my life, all right? But anyway, I had to point that out. But anyway.
Glad you got that out.
Got it out, right. So the NFL took the cake for performative justice. Slogans on the back of helmets, slogans in end zone. We're going to sing the Black National Anthem before the game. But do you all realize, I don't know if we have any physicians in here, that when former NFL athletes think they have concussion issues or they've lost some kind of cognitive ability, they can go get tested. And the test will determine whether or not they get a payout or not. The NFL for the last 10 years has used something called race norming. Basically, they, in essence, I'm gonna use myself as an example. Yeah, Leonard, you lost some cognitive ability, but you were dumb to begin with, so you're not getting a payout. I mean, it was literally that. Mm-hmm. They had one standard for white players, another standard for Black players, so Black players were disproportionately getting denied the concussion benefits. And so, but on one hand, they're doing all this performative stuff, but on the other hand, you are employing these physicians and telling them to use this racist scientific stuff to limit payouts. And so that's what we call performative justice. I mean, I don't know about you all, but I was getting emails every day from companies. Black Lives Matter from, what's the name of the big pet store and all these strip malls, what's it called?
Petco?
Petco. I don't even own a pet. And so that is what we call performative justice. And I'm losing my voice. Here we go. There was a situation, and this gets to performative justice. There was a situation at the University of Texas Law School. They got about 3 black professors. Okay, so I got a call from the dean one day. He said, Leonard, we have an issue. Some students had a problem with a question on the exam. Black professor teaching a constitutional law class had an exam question. It just said, defend school segregation from a legal perspective. Now, I was always taught that a good lawyer could argue both sides of an argument. Mm-hmm. This is an intellectual exercise. Oh, the students were up in arms. Mm-hmm. So when the dean asked me to come over there and talk to the students, I said, I bet you it's going to be a room full of white students. Mm-hmm. I was wrong. It was 10 white students, 1 black student, and 1 Latino. And the ringleader was a 30-year-old white student. Oh, Leonard, Dr. Moore, that professor should be fired? He should never be able to give an exam again? If the university keeps him, all of his exams should go through some approval process? They were that upset over a question. And I asked the law professor and the dean to leave. I said, let me ask you a question. I said, this really upset y'all, huh? They said, yes. I said, how many law students did this school bring in this past year? They said, 296. I said, how many were black? I said, 7. So I said, so this is my issue. You are more upset about a question on the exam. But if you would ask black students what they want, they want more black students in the school. And that is the kind of performative justice we got to check. Mm-hmm. Even with taking down some of the statues. Understand, if you ask black students on these campuses, what is removing the statues rank in rank order, they probably say number 8. But what happens in my issue with white liberals is that they often assume that they know what's best for black people, mm-hmm. and they want to speak for black people. Listen to this. I live in Austin, Texas. There's a community, it's gentrified now, but 10 years ago, it was East Austin, an older black community. And I said, told my students that we're going to do something real radical. I said, let's sit in here and brainstorm about what you think the community needs. Better schools, recreational facilities, grocery store, all that stuff. I said, we're going to do something radical. We're going to go knock on the doors for 4 hours, and we're going to find out what they want. You know what they wanted? Number one was? They wanted speed bumps in the street. You know why? Because people flying through there trying to get to downtown, their kids were getting hit by cars. So the point is, you wouldn't know that unless you live there. And I tell white liberals all the time, the number one thing you can do is ask black folk, hey, what can I help you fight for? Mm-hmm.
You also say in this chapter, this is step one, see color.
Absolutely.
See color. And when I was a teacher, this makes so much sense because our students of color are sitting in bodies of color. They are navigating their world in bodies of color. And yet you say there's this hesitation in teaching for teachers to see color. So talk a little bit more about why that's an important teaching move.
Every year if I teach 1,000 students in the fall semester, 2 classes, I'm gonna have about 14 Muslim women who wear a hijab. 14, and about 50 undocumented students. Y'all may call me legals up here, but in my world, illegal is not a noun, all right? I have to see those Muslim women for who they are because their experience is different. I have to see the undocumented students because their experience is different. Whenever somebody walks into class late, they all turn their head because they're thinking, is that ICE coming to get me? Or whenever they get a text message, they're thinking, oh, did my uncle get deported? Did my grandmother get deported? So students are not robots. And I'm not saying you stereotype people, but you gotta understand, we live in a racialized society, so you have to see race. When the basketball player walks in my class who's 6'10", I have to understand what he deals with every day. Mm-hmm. And so, but I think saying I don't see race, I think it's a cop out. Mm-hmm. And I don't let people take that out. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I've got a few more questions, and then we're going to open it up to the audience for questions. So this one is a teacher question, because people think college professors just arrive, or teachers just arrive, and we stand in a pulpit and we just talk. So I want to hear a little bit about What skills, teaching skills or teacher moves are you still working on as a teacher?
I don't know. I moved away from exams. And so I'll give like assignments. So for instance, in my Black History class, my Black Power class this year, they had to, one of the projects was they had to convince, they had to do a project where they had to convince the majority conservative Texas state legislature why they should make Black History a requirement in every high school in Texas. Mm. I'm doing stuff like that.
Yeah.
Another one, they had to go interview 10 white people about, ask your white people in your circle, what do they think are the most important issues in Black America and why? Mm. So I'm moving away from the give me the notes back, and it's more of I'm sending them out.
Yeah,
where they can do research and learn how to think strategically and stuff like that. Yeah. And my greatest one, they hate it. I say, you know, you've just been hired as President Trump's campaign director, and your strategy is to get help Donald Trump get more Black votes. But it's stuff like that. It's interesting to read, you know what I mean? And it's not all the same.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then they're building the historical context around
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So what are you worried about right now as a teacher scholar? What's worrying you?
I think the left, Democrats, or woke folk, whatever you want to call it. One thing I agree with these conservatives on, you know, we have drowned out conservative voices on the college campus. We've done it, and we got to admit it. And as a result, the college campus is not nearly as vibrant. So we have a group of students on UT's campus called the Young Conservatives of Texas. It's like 5 people. But as reprehensible as some of their stuff is, it's brilliant. So they had one year, they had an immigrant hunt. You chase people around the campus. Another year they had an affirmative action bake sale, where I think the white donut was $2, the Asian donut was like $1.85, and the Black donut was free, all right? Here's my point. They have a right to do that. They have every right to do that. And I just tell the students, you know, you gotta be okay being in places where people see the world differently than you. And you can't get upset and walk out. You can't get mad. I told the students the other day, right before the semester was over, when you start working, nobody's going to ask you what your pronoun is. And they seem to be, that triggered some of them. And I said, if we don't prepare you all to operate in the real world and be effective, we failed you. And I tell my activists, you got to be about bringing people to the center. We had a big debate about the transgender swimmer at Penn. I don't care what you say. I don't care what you say. That person has an advantage over those women in the swimming pool. And people are afraid to say, do I believe the person has a right to identify whatever they want to? Absolutely. But do they have a right to compete competitively in the Ivy League? I don't think so. But it's like you can't say anything. Because if you say anything, you come across as transphobic. No, I'm not transphobic. He was just competing on the men's side the year before. Couldn't win. And my point is, when you hold up that as, oh, this is a civil rights issue. No, that person has a right to swim wherever they want. But when it comes to that, and I think it's stuff like that, that I believe sometimes hurts the cause.
So
y'all okay?
Okay. So my last question is, what do you hope?
I don't like it, but I don't care, all right? Go swim at the YMCA. Okay.
No, we
need... No, because and people say, well, Dr. Moore, you're going to make the slippery slope argument. Maybe I am. But let's move on. Go ahead. All right, let's go.
Well, what we're trying to do here is set the table for some conversation. So we're going to invite you
in. And that comment made some people uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. Well,
why?
In your book, you say discomfort is the fertilizer for growth.
Absolutely.
So I think you just did some fertilizer.
And so let me say this. I used to listen to Rush Limbaugh every day. I didn't agree with Rush, but I understood that he spoke for millions of white people who felt like they didn't have a voice. So I'm always about learning and getting new perspectives. I want to hear other, but if you shut yourself out to other perspectives, you can't grow. And I miss Rush. He was a brilliant commentator. Didn't agree. The only thing we agreed upon was Jesus. But if we'd have talked about Jesus for 10 minutes, we would have disagreed about that too. All right?
So my last and maybe quick question, and then I see you with the microphone, is I asked you what you're worried about. I want to know what you're hopeful about as a teacher scholar.
I really thrive on debate in class. I thrive on being provocative. I thrive on often voicing the perspectives of white conservatives, because I think although I disagree, those perspectives have value. So I don't know if I'm hopeful. I mean, I am glad that I'm getting more. I mean, over 20,000 students, probably about 75% have been white. I am happy that white students want to learn more about the history. Mm-hmm. Anybody can go to a lecture, but when you sit there for 15 weeks and you read 4 autobiographies, mm-hmm. 2 of them by black women, 2 of them by black men, you can't help but soak some of that up. Mm-hmm. And it changes people. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I want to thank everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, author and professor Brooks E. Hefner discusses his book, Black Pulp, Genre Fiction and the Shadow of Jim Crow, recorded live at the American Writers Festival. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.